everybody, and welcome back to More of a Comment Than a Question. My name is Paul Connor, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Rachel Hartman. Rachel, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Getting over some sickness from SPSB, but it was totally worth it. Had a great time. Turns out we actually have fans, or at least I do. So shout out to all the people who came and said hi to me and that they're fans of the pod. It was really great hearing that we have listeners.
Yeah, so this is interesting, right? So I am still on the job market, and I it's a complex situation. I'm waiting to hear back from a couple of schools, and I still, you know, this is kind of why we haven't done a pod in a while, because I was just thinking, okay, while I'm on the job market, you know, maybe just step back from public debates about contentious issues. Probably can only hurt me in that context, not help me. So we haven't done a pod for a long time, but I think that's still more or less my policy, and we probably shouldn't be doing this. However, Rachel met so many people came up to Rachel at SPSP and said, hey, we're fans of the pod, that she really has sort of put the hard word on me and convinced me to do another pod. So here we are, we're doing this. And, you know, hopefully it's like not going to be a controversial topic or anything like that, and it won't scuttle my chances of getting a job, but who knows. I will say this. Nobody came up to me and said that they were fans of the pod. So I also, there's something like, I also have part of me that's like, okay, well, if you're so popular and you have all the fans, maybe you should just do the podcast yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really is just because I was more visible being at the Cloud Research booth, but you never know, maybe people just like me more. Well, maybe.
Yeah, you know, it's very possible. Or they're just worried that I'm just gonna, if they talk to me, like, just start on a long monologue and they won't be able to escape the conversation. I'll never let them speak, which I've kind of done to consecutive co-hosts now. But yeah, I had a good time at SPS. As well. I actually chaired a session, which was kind of fun because it was very stress-free. I just had to talk for like a minute and introduce the speakers. But, you know, I would have liked a chance to talk about my research as well, I guess. But, you know, maybe if I get a job, that'll happen sometime in the future.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah. And Atlanta was, you know, interesting city too. But we should introduce our topic and our guests. We have multiple guests, I think, for the first time since you and Manny came on the pod. I can't remember.
Well, you keep forgetting people. We had Carlos and Annalisa.
Oh, yeah, that was a four-way. Sure. Yeah. Yes. Shout out to Carlos and Annalisa. Saw them both in Atlanta. Look, I'm getting old. My memory is not what it once was. And it was never that good. So today I just wanted to talk about ChatGPT, because this is something, not just ChatGPT, but AI in general, artificial intelligence, you know, future of humanity, how long we have before we're all slaughtered by the robots. And so we both brought our own guest to the pod, some people we know who are interested in this. Would you like to introduce your special someone?
Sure. So I know this guy somewhat well. So we have Luke Hartman, who is my husband. There is some nepotism on this pod. Luke is a software engineer who works at a startup called Tumult Labs, and they do differential privacy. And he also knows a lot about AI and all sorts of other stuff that I don't really understand. And so this will be an opportunity for him to talk to people who understand it better, probably.
Awesome. Yeah. Hello. I don't have anything to add to that. That was thank you for the very generous introduction.
You're finally on the pod, Luke. So Luke is
number one fan.
Second biggest fan after Rachel. Well, I guess Rachel, you're not a fan anymore. You're on the pod now. So I guess Luke,
I have to compete with Carlos, I think, as like my arch nemesis.
No, well, I think you're the biggest fan purely because when we floated the idea of t-shirts, and like selling t-shirts. Well, I don't remember your exact words, but it was something to the tune of, I'll pay whatever you're asking to get a more of a common t-shirt. Which, yeah, so we have a blank check from Luke when we finally make the t-shirts. Okay, so let me introduce my special someone. So I am not married to this person, unfortunately, but he's a friend, and he's been on the podcast before. So it's Alex Kogan. And Alex, I invited you on just because ever since I've known you, I've known that you were fascinated by AI. You were sort of talking to me about GPT-3 before anybody else. You were playing around with it a long time before anybody else. You sort of introduced me to the concept of singularity. So I said I would introduce you as a leading expert in AI. That's maybe not exactly true, but I do think you have a lot more insight than most into sort of the inner workings, so like what's going on under the hood of these models. And you've spent a long time thinking about the trajectory of where we're going with this kind of stuff. So thanks for joining us, Alex.
Yeah, glad to be back in the pod.
Yeah. So I guess I should. Yeah. So Alex was a professor of psychology at Cambridge University. That came to an end in somewhat interesting circumstances. people can Google it. People can listen to the previous pod. Your new project is to save academic publishing. Do you have an elevator pitch about that? Well, we don't. That could be a whole podcast on its own, I know. But like, do you have a sort of a brief update / elevator pitch of what you're trying to do with the Scholar Exchange?
Yeah, I think the simple take is that anybody that's done academic publishing or has been in academia knows the publishing process sucks in many, many ways. It's really slow and it's good for no one. It's not good for the authors. It's not good for the publishers. It's definitely not good for the reviewers. So the Scholar Exchange aims at fixing most of those problems. And I think my dream is when you submit a paper, you get it back in 2 weeks, right? Not 6 months or whatever long, 2 weeks. And I think the theory is if we do that, we'll accelerate the pace of science. And I think that's a dream. And we're going to have a longer talk about it some other time, but that's the pitch.
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. And I do actually think that would be a good podcast topic. And Rachel's nodding, so that's a great sign. Our number one fan, Luke, is just didn't look as impressed by that potential topic, but don't worry, Luke. No, you'll enjoy great. The episode. You'll enjoy.
He's a software engineer. He's not in science.
Okay. Yeah. So.
Also, well, I'm on one paper, but I wasn't very, it's just on archive. And so it's still in the works, but I will be completely shielded from all of the pain of publishing because we have other people to deal with that nonsense.
You're a lucky man.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Awesome. Okay, so the topic today is AI and, you know, ChatGPT and large language models and sort of like whether humanity can survive what's coming. But I wanted to start off just by asking our two sort of ring-in experts to just sort of take us through the recent history of this stuff. So obviously, like, I, like a lot of people in academia, got very, very interested in this stuff when ChatGPT came out, which was only a couple of months ago. And all of a sudden, it just seemed there had been this massive acceleration in the capabilities of these large language models. Like ChatGPT has just sort of blown me away. I think it's blown a lot of people away in terms of what it can do. You know, the fact that it can code. I mean, I've used it to sort of rewrite and or sort of redraft some of my like professional like job market materials, and I found it really, really useful and really capable for that purpose. And it's also, I think, like a lot of people, what is so freaky about it is not its current capabilities, but just when you just start thinking about, okay, well, you know, this is run by GPT-3. Which is this large language model that's actually been around for quite a while, and GPT-4 is coming soon. And so, yeah, just thinking about the possibilities, I mean, and thinking about the repercussions for sort of society and the possibilities for what technology is is imminent, or you know, in the near future, or medium to long future range. It's just like, it's quite mind blowing, and it's you know, the public discussions around it have been kind of interesting, but almost like, I also think like maybe focused on things that maybe aren't as important as the actual technology and the sort of progression into the future. So yeah, like, I guess like I need to pick one of you, but I just want to hear like, can you catch us up of like, what is this technology? Where did it come from? And sort of how did we get to where we are like right now, before we sort of talk about where we're going in the future. So maybe Alex, do you want to take this?
Yeah, totally. So I think the start of this goes back like 7 decades. People have been thinking about this idea of a neural network since the 1950s. And it's a pretty simple thesis. It's the human brain is the most powerful machine we have. Let's try to learn from the way it works, which is neurons connected up in a network. So like the theoretical basis at the highest level has been around for a long, long time, but like what was not around for a long, long time was computational power. And so like people did work on this on and on and on. And where AI started to really make major, major breakthroughs, let's say in recent history, was first in the area of vision. So people started to use these neural networks to pretty astounding effects in trying to do things like hand recognition and like faces and things like that. And that got really, really good. But then in the last, I'd say, 7 years, there's been kind of an explosion in research in something focused more on language. So a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about today is probably going to be around sort of like natural language processing and things like in that general world of text. And I'd say like one of the big monumental things that happened was there's a paper written out by Google about this architecture called the transformer. And the title was something like, all you need is attention. And this is really big. Like this is like a really monumental paper because it introduced this new architecture and said like, hey, if you arrange a neural network in this way, and then you like go through this process of like fine tuning it and training it, you can get some really cool stuff. And so then a bunch of folks started to build bigger and bigger and bigger models using this transformer architecture. Google's got a bunch, obviously Facebook has some, and OpenAI came about. And like the thing to understand here is like these are very large models with a lot of data. They're basically taking 45 terabytes of information, of text, and smashing it through to try to tune it. And it's basically like the internet, all of Wikipedia and things like that. It is expensive to do. So I think when GPT-3 first came out, the estimates were they needed to spend $5 million to train it once. So like, if you think about just like the computational power involved here, it's really, really not cheap, but they did it. And now they're building bigger and bigger models. So where things started to get potentially spicy was around this like GPT-3 line. So there's been GPT-1, GPT-2, and GPT-3 got really interesting because you could kind of talk to it. They had this like big aha moment where like, if you give it just text in like normal English, it would kind of respond in like sensible ways sometimes. And you could then like do other crazy things, like be like, hey, write me a rap song about this podcast. And it would do a great job at that. And then just kept going. So like ChatGPT obviously rolled out this past fall. Now it's based on sort of like an extended version of GPT-3. It's GPT-3.5, as they like to say, which for those that like the API, literally today, the GPT or ChatGPT has gone live in the API. So now you could actually use it programmatically. And it's pretty great. That's kind of what I've been doing all day, just getting that integrated into our platform. I think that's not a bad place to stop in terms of the catch up. I think the much more profound questions are going to be, what does it mean for us as a society now? What are going to be the consequences going forward? Even like ignoring the singularity question. I think that's a really cool one, but that's a little bit down the road. I think there's like consequences between like now and like 10 years from now. They're going to be pretty profound, and hopefully we'll dig in.
just before we sort of move on to those really interesting questions, I get to a point with this stuff where I actually, so I've fit a neural network before, right? So I did this, I did this sort of data science workshop kind of thing, and we fit a neural network, and essentially we were trying to predict from these images of medical scans, which ones were tumors and which ones were benign. But in that I understood really quite well, like as just a sort of extension of linear modeling where you just didn't sort of understand what was going on in the hood. So we had the, what we were predicting from, which were these images, and we had to make them all very standard. So they had to have all the same number of pixels and stuff like that. And that was almost like our independent variable. And then it was sort of, the model was like, there was all these, there are these layers and these neurons connecting with each other. But then the output was just sort of a yes or no, like it's a tumor or it's not, right? And so like, that's very like intuitive to me, right? Because it's like, okay, so the model's just sort of, it has this ground truth that it's sort of like fine tuning all its parameters, and it's trying to just get as good as possible at taking a new image and coming up with an answer, yes or no. And it's sort of predicting a probability. And if that probability is beyond 50%, that's a yes. And then, and so like, so then you train it on the training data, and then you test it on the test data, and you know, you try to build it. Okay. So I understand like that, I fit a neural network, but with this stuff, with these large language models, I get to a point where I honestly don't know what's going on. Like what is the input? What is the output? What is the sort of training process? How is the model being like told, yeah, you did a good job versus yeah, you did a bad job? How do you know, Alex, like, or Luke, like how actually I would go about building a large language model like these?
Luke, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. So there's actually, I think it's like Andrew Karpathy has a 2-hour video where he actually goes over it. So basically, I think actually, language models are probably one of the easier cases to sort of like understand how they work, right? So it, in some sense, it's sort of like, well, at least like the ChatGPT before you get to sort of like, or the GPT free before you get to like how ChatGPT works, is because that's a little bit more complicated. But basically, you just have a document, right? And then you could imagine, let's say you have, like it's not able to look at like infinitely large like context or whatever, right? So let's say that you can have like, you know, the last like 5 pages or whatever. Okay. So you take like the last 5 pages that you look at and you try to just predict the next like character, for example, right? And then now it's basically just like a regular supervised learning problem that you can imagine, right? So like you have like your X, Y things. So the X's are all of the contexts that you could have, and the Y's are just like the next character, right? And you can now just take like all the documents on the internet, and they now nicely fit in this sort of like supervised learning model. And I think like a lot of sort of AI stuff you can think of as like, I think there's like two, like a lot of the tricks are just like how can you turn something into supervised learning? Like the sort of model that you can think of that like makes a lot of sense. You're like, you know, like especially a lot of these like generative models, it's sort of like you can like sort of do weird things sometimes to sort of like get something to turn it into like a supervised learning problem. And then it sort of like makes sense why it works, right? So you can sort of think of like these models as like really good at supervised learning. And then there's a lot of like shenanigans and things you can do to sort of like bend things that you wouldn't think would be able to fit into that paradigm. And then once you get into that paradigm, we're like really good at it.
Let me build on that a little bit. I think the easiest place to understand this is the output, right? What is the output? And as Luke's saying, like, it's actually really simple. It's either the next character or the next word. So these models, all they're trying to predict the output is what should be the next word. And so like in English, I think there's like 26,000 words that are commonly used, right? So you get a probability of like, what is the probability the next word is the? What is the probability the next word is Alex? What is the probability the next word is banana, right? And you just take the ones that have the highest probability. And then you like say, okay, now that I've got this, let me just put it into sort of the inputs, and we'll get to the input in a second, and then predict the next word and the next word. So when you see like ChatGPT output, like, you know, a paragraph, it actually like predicted that like 300 times, and there's like 300 words or so, right? It's like, it kept going. So the output is just the next word. the input is you have a piece of text and you need to convert that into a mathematical vector, right? Or like you need to really an array. And like, well, how would you do that? And so like, I think that it's not exactly how it works because there's some layers trying to like reduce the data. But the one way you could do it is like, imagine you have a word. Well, there's 26,000 words. So let me make an array, right? Where it's like zeros everywhere except one for like the position of that word. And it'll just assign that. And then if you want to have like a document, well, it's like a matrix, right? The first word is the first column, and the second column, the third column, and you kind of just fill in the matrix, and you start to like build that out, and you can just feed that in. But that's a mathematical representation of a paragraph or whatever data you want, and you could really make it as big as you want because you just add extra columns into that matrix. And so you could think about the input from that perspective, and I find that the easiest way for me to sort of like sort of understand like exactly how it goes. And then really what you're doing, the model is trying to predict. And then if there was an extra column, which is like the next word, right in the pair of the document, which of these 26,000 rows could it possibly be? And it's just trying to pick that out. And then when you've got that, then you fill that column in and like, and let's do it again for the next one and the next one and the next one.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's quite helpful to me. I think, it kind of makes sense, but I think Rachel's fans are probably really wanting to hear from her right now, so let me just give you the floor, Rachel.
I don't know. I've heard Luke explain this or similar concepts many times, and it still doesn't like completely make sense to me, which is okay because I feel like, you know, if it was possible to explain it in 10 minutes, then that, like, why are we paying so many people so much money to work on it? So I'm fine with just being mystified and like thinking of it as like a magic box that, you know, does cool things. Yeah. And I think, like, I don't know, like one thing that I think about when you just like talk about like predicting and kind of like generating things based off of what it's learned, it's just like, it seems like humanity is so not creative in that, like you can so easily like predict what the next thing is and you would be right because like there's only so many different ways of saying something, or like, you know, it's like we tend to think of ourselves as kind of, you know, creating like original content, but I feel like the fact that ChatGPT can do it so well says something about how unoriginal we actually are. So that's my kind of philosophical take on this.
Yeah, that sort of reminds me. So as I was sort of doing some reading prior to this episode, I came upon this this piece and this apparently it's a well-known analogy, and I'm curious both of our guests what your thoughts are about this, because I had some thoughts, and it was this sort of analogy made, I think, in an academic article by a computational linguist who was trying to make the argument that people are very different from large language models, and large language models are not like people. And so she came up with this analogy, which was like, okay, so imagine like there's two individuals stranded on desert islands in the ocean, individual A and individual B, and they discover that they can communicate with each other via telegram. So there's a wire that passes between the islands under the water, right? So they start just chatting and they're talking about everything and they're exchanging information. And then, but then there's this super intelligent octopus that's like has the ability to intercept these messages. So the octopus lives under the water, never goes above the water, but it can intercept these messages and sort of learn from them. And then at a certain point, the octopus starts to pretend to be person B. So person A is now talking to the octopus, and the octopus is just sort of parroting back everything it's learned, like it's sort of like a large language model, and it's just sort of trying to predict what person A would say, and person B would say, and person A is fooled until person A is attacked by a bear. So these are quite weird desert islands, but they're attacked by a bear, and they send a message, "Help, I'm being attacked by a bear. I have some sticks. What should I do?" At which point the octopus doesn't know how to respond. Because it doesn't know what a bear is, and it doesn't know what sticks are, apparently. And so, like, in the the analogy is supposed to establish a difference between humans and large language models in that, I guess it's trying to make the point that, no, the large language models can only sort of repeat back things that it's learnt. They use the phrase, it has no real world reference. Like it has no experience with bears, has no experience with sticks. It's just sort of repeating back the things that it's learnt. Struck me as like not an amazing analogy. And yeah, what do you think about this?
I personally don't love it. And I think that's because like, it's a straw man, right? Like you could ease, like if that person on the other island was born on that island and there are no sticks or bears on that island, wouldn't they also have no idea how to help with that? But they'd still be a person, right? Like, I think it's just speaking to, we will only know things that we have experience with. I think if you want to push it, it's like a question of like, is there true novelty or creativity? Can you come up with an original idea and thought? And honestly, I think it's really hard. Like, I think most ideas are either derivative of previous ideas or they're just like sort of accidental connections, right? Like I often think about science this way, right? Like we'll publish a paper and somebody halfway around the world will read that paper and be like, ooh, I could connect, you know, Paul's idea with my idea and get a slightly newer idea. But it's just all kind of like reconfiguring things that already exist and connecting them.
Right.
Like the AI models can do this, right? Like I play with GPT-3 all the time. I'll give it things it's never seen and ask it to do something novel and it's, or pseudo novel, and it's able to do it. So like, I'll give you a stupid example. I've been using it a lot for a company I've been running for the last 5 years where we do customer service, and where I would give it a problem. Somebody writes in with a customer service issue of like, I need to price adjust my order. I bought some watches and now they're cheaper, right? Can you please price adjust them? But then we throw in something that's a little spicy. We say like, hey, I just had a death in my family and I would really appreciate you doing this. I don't know that like GPT-3 was ever trained in a scenario of somebody's writing in to a watch company to do a price adjustment and acknowledging sort of a death in the family. So I've done it. But I'm like, write me a good response. Plus, do it in the form of a rap song. And it does a really good job at that. And I'm positive it's never seen a rap song about that particular situation. And that's going to feel pretty like novel and original. But it's just kind of like that same thing of like, I'm combining different things I've seen into something new. But it can really do that and like arguably better than most human beings can do it. Cause like I would have a hard time writing a rap song about somebody's customer service problem and like the death in the family. That's like anything you rhyme, right? Like, that's a ridiculous task.
I'm not, it's not really clear to me what they're trying to get at. It definitely, like, the most salient thing to me was also the out of domain dimension, which like, yeah, so like that doesn't seem like that's, there's anything different about AI seeing people there. I mean, there's this other thing about sort of like language models being trapped in only language and sort of like that being a problem. But and like maybe that's something interesting about language models, but like that's not even something like about AI, right? Like, because there people are working on these like multimodal sort of like models that can, you know, have, what I mean by that is like, you might have it can like understand images and text and like other things and like audio and like that kind of thing.
So we didn't mention them, but some of the image generating AI has become really impressive as well. Yeah, and I was wondering that too. Like, right, like, so I have this one task. This is another interesting point actually that I wanted to talk about, because like, As amazing as ChatGPT is, and as impressive as it is in terms of writing code and stuff like that, so it, like it can write code, right? But I do coding, and I've never really used it, because I just suspect that it really won't succeed at the kind of level that it would be useful for me currently, and also just like. So I have a task right now I need a research assistant for, which is like a pretty easy task, which in theory, I think it like in a few years AI might be able to do, but I just don't think these models can do it yet, right? So like I just need somebody to sort of look at a bunch of photographs and do some basic coding of them. So like give it 1,000 photographs and just say, can you make me a spreadsheet whereby like, you know, there's a variable and it, like if one of these photos has like a Facebook overlay, right? You know, where people add like, I support Ukraine to their Facebook profile picture. Can you just like code which ones have that and which ones don't have some kind of overlay? And like that would be pretty easy to train an AI model to do. But at the moment, like with only 1,000 photos to sort of code, like that's sort of not enough data to sort of train my own model, like I don't think. And then like the effort to me of going through and training. Yeah, like so there's no like sort of AI system where I could just sort of like type in these instructions and treat it like an RA yet. So I guess it just makes me question, like, you know, how long will it be until it's actually putting like a lot of people out of work, given that it is still quite like limited in its application, and it might be quite difficult for it to sort of get to the point where it's sort of that useful where you could just sort of treat it like a human and email it a task and it would just do that task for you.
So let me take a stab at this one. So like I'll say at the outset, I think these LLMs are kind of a technological jump point. Like if we think back over like the last, I don't know, 50 years, right? Where has new technology come that really disrupted everything, right? And the ones that stick out to me, and Luke, I'll be curious if the same ones stick out to you, is like the smartphone, right? Everything just like turned upside down from that. The internet, right? Like, or particularly the web browser. I think the web browser was the thing that made it like just go. The personal computer, right? Electricity. It's like stuff like that, where it's just like things really got shifted. So I actually think this is one of them. And the areas where I think that we're going to see the biggest disruption first is going to be white collar jobs that pay people under $100,000. Like, so what are these things? This is customer service. This is failed outreach. This is copy editing, things like that. Now I work in the customer service industry, right? So like I see this firsthand. We've already implemented GPT-3 directly into our stuff. Now we were well set up to be able to tune it carefully or basically guide it so it doesn't bullshit. So like one thing that like the biggest problem with all of these models is something called hallucinations. But the more common way to call it is bullshitting. If it doesn't know, it'll still give you an answer and it'll be just equally convinced of the veracity of that answer. So like a lot of like people that are trying to build apps using this just need to have a really good strategy for like anti-bullshit. And so we happen to have one in our case. But the results we started to generate, we would show our clients, and our clients consistently are like, please stop using humans. This is better than your humans. And it's because it's able to read and write at a pretty good level. Customer service isn't that hard. You're like synthesizing some information that we're providing it anyway via APIs. And then you just need to show some empathy, which is like a lot of mirroring and like acknowledging what the person is saying. So those kind of tasks where people sit at a computer and mostly interact with text, but it's pretty repetitive, right? It's not that technical. It's really not that hard to train. All that stuff is about to die. 3 million Americans do customer service, just as one industry, right? Like these are pretty common jobs. And these are some of the better jobs you could get that don't require like advanced technical skills. Like I don't think anybody's going to put Luke out of a job anytime soon as far as like actual software engineering. Like that's hard, and there's just such a dramatic difference between like a really good engineer and an average engineer. But like the things that are more repetitive and where there's just less leverage, I'm like, it's already good enough. You just need to like guide it correctly. And then you just get into all these social implications of it. So that's all scary. The counter argument to this is like, oh, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to remark that I actually found it really interesting because I feel like we spoke pretty soon after ChatGPT sort of came out. Yeah. And I remember saying to you at that time, so are you going to implement it in your company. I mean, we should make clear what this company is. It's like sort of this remote, like big call centers and AI assisted call centers, essentially for different clients. Are you going to implement it? And at that time, I remember you said to me, well, no, because I think it's not going to be quite good enough. You know, even if it's 80% accurate, that missing 20% really matters. Fast forward a few weeks and you were like,
I was wrong.
We're implementing it. It's happening, which is very, very fascinating to me, because you, of all the people I know, sort of know the most about this stuff, but it, like, even you was kind of blindsided by how good this thing was.
Yeah. It's funny. Like, I had access to it for years, right? I've had GPT-3 API access for like 2 years. But like, I think I didn't move on it for two reasons, and both reasons were wrong. The first reason was, I didn't think it was going to be good enough. But once I was able to use the tech we had built to constrain it and provided the facts, and we've been building towards this reality, like, can we provide all the facts that through like really good integrations and things like that, we were blown away by how good it was under that very special constraint. I think the second reason why I was pretty hesitant is more a business risk. So folks that dig into my personal history will discover that I had a pretty big impact on the Facebook API, where the Facebook API used to be very open and then became very closed. And a lot of companies that had been built on that API being open, and a lot of businesses were generally ruined. And I was pretty concerned that somebody else would come and like pee in the soup, so to speak, and like do something folks found unsavory with these open AI models, and like all the APIs would get closed down. I talked to some reporter buddies of mine. I made a lot of reporter friends through my experiences, and they were actually pretty sure that a repeat of the Facebook API wouldn't happen. And their thesis was like, look, Facebook wanted to shut down that API, right? Like, you just gave them a reason, but here, this is how they're going to make money. This is not going away. So like, and it's going to be commoditized, and it's going to be a fierce battle. So like, bad cases, good cases, doesn't matter. This is here to stay. So don't worry, just go. Because right now it is going to be a gold rush to try to like figure out how to use this correctly. Because if I'm right, and it's like the web browser, think about the companies that came to dominate our societies, right? They were started at that point of like the web browsers here, and now all this stuff is possible. So mm-hmm. We might be in a similar spot, or at least that's my view. Like, we're in a similar spot. So like, there's going to be a lot of these companies born right now.
What do you think, Luke? Like, what's your perspective in your industry? You're a software engineer. Like, in your company, how are people sort of talking about this, and like, whose job's on the line?
I have like maybe broader comments, and then I'll talk about that. So yeah, like just like, so I sort of think like there's sort of maybe like three cases I can think of, or like three like broad categories of cases that where you're gonna like see like a potential uptake. So I think one of them, maybe like the hardest one, is where like the model is just like actually more reliable than a human. And then I think maybe that's like the hardest sort of thing. And it sounds like maybe like the sort of like call center use case is in that category. I think one thing, like a consideration here, is that like I think when people think about how reliable people are, I think they like do not use the same standards that they use when they're thinking about how reliable AIs are. If you put me in an explain off with ChatGPT, Rachel can attest that it will probably beat me for like most things that could be explained. And like, yeah, that's like a very sort of like core human sort of thing to be able to do. Okay, so that's sort of one thing. It's like, is it like literally just like actually more reliable than a human? If you can do that, then like, you know, I mean, I think there's like other considerations, like whatever. But I think maybe
you're
that's
funnier
like
than ChatGPT, Luke.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you're just not using the right prompts. And then maybe the other two cases are sort of where it's like you can like really easily and nicely integrate it into a workflow, and then have a human verify it, right? So I think this is sort of think of like brainstorming. So you like ask, you have a list, and you say, ChatGPT, give me more things I can add to this list. And then you look at these, you're like, yeah, one of these is actually great. The other are kind of crap. You add it to the list, you ask it again. You kind of like go through that loop. That you're like, for something to go wrong there, the human really has to like mess up, right? And so I think the sort of like thing that's most relevant to my job sort of falls in here, which is like using these sorts of things for like really powerful autocomplete, right? So I use GitHub Copilot a lot when I'm like at my, and it's like actually like incredibly useful. It's like very, very noticeable how helpful it can be. Like it can literally like auto like suggest like hundreds of characters and be right with every single one of them. And I'll hit tab and then I'm like, now I'm like another test was written or something like that, right? So in that sense, it's like, it's not really replacing me, but it's making much more productive. You know, if it made programmers like enough more productive, that's sort of like, there's no longer enough demand for programmers. Like that's, you know what I mean? Maybe that's not, I don't think we're like there right now, but you know, yeah. Like if you made all programmers like a billion times more productive, you know, it'd be plausible that we're there, but that'd be a very weird world. And then I think maybe the third case is where you can like have like no human in the loop. And it's also not like just like more level human. It's just, you can like verify like automatically that the output of it is correct. So I think maybe an example of this is like finding proofs in math, where like if it's sort of structured in the right way, where you're like actually sort of like building it up from like axioms and like a, you know, not just like a human written paper that's sort of like not like, you know, that's harder. But then it's like you can like have like a 300 line program that can sort of like, you can very, you know, that can sort of verify that the output is correct very like efficiently. And in that case, it's like you don't even need a human in the loop. You just sort of like set it up and let it go. And you don't even need to look at the output. It's just like you can be just very confident that it's all working. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of like think like there's like a lot of stuff that falls into those three cases. Yeah. So and then I think sort of a lot of things for like are like in that middle case that are just like which is maybe like the most exciting one, where I sort of like ask ChatGPT, like, you know, I want to order a pizza, and then it like gives you a cart, it's all filled out, has the pizza. And then you just like hit like checkout, and then like I'm excited for that. Like companies are excited for that. Like I think you know that's something that will be good. And then that's an easy way for people to make money, right? Because whoever has the chatbot will be able to get a cut of that too.
Exactly. But, yeah.
I think generally, like when people talk about people losing their jobs because of new technology, like it's like sure they're gonna lose their jobs, but then there will be new jobs, and like we'll all be better off because we have better technology. So like I think that it's probably going to happen, like Alex was saying, for people at sort of that like mid-range, but who cares, like they'll just get better jobs and we'll so I don't care about people losing their jobs is the main takeaway.
So let me like kind of cook on that a little bit. I'll talk about like people that do customer service. I think for folks that do customer service, they're oftentimes folks that don't have a college degree and don't have like particularly strong skills to like go level up substantially. I could tell you that like a lot of the employees we work with, if they can't work for us or another call center, they would typically go down to work in like food and bev, so like McDonald's, things like that, warehouse work or retail. Things that are just a bit more physically demanding, but tend to pay less. And so like, that's one concern. Like, so there's two directions this can go, right? Like LLMs broadly can start this new era where there's many new jobs created that just do not exist today. And I think this is like the best case scenario, right? And like folks can step into those jobs because like, I completely agree for like basically everybody except the folks being displaced, this is a lot better. Like just the customer service example of like, you will get a response right away and it will be by something that reads really well and writes really well. That is a better experience than what happens today. It will be cheaper for the companies to provide you the service, so they could actually charge you less money for the products they're going to be selling to you. So that's also better, right? And the companies that like provide these customer services are going to be really happy because there's fewer people to manage, better margins. Everybody wins, except maybe these employees. So, like, if they're going to go into these new jobs, that's going to be awesome. I think there is a risk that, like, especially like if you look at the history of the United States, we've had kind of a shrinking middle class, and that middle class often goes down towards the poor end rather than like the richer end. But this could be more of that because, like, the automation is coming not for like the worst jobs, like the lowest paying jobs, but it's coming for that next tier, so like the lower middle class. And I think like I could definitely see a world where there's just going to be a segment of society that becomes poor on average, right? And then that's the other side. Like, we'll have to see which way it goes.
Well, it seems like also, I mean, like food workers also are like losing their jobs, being displaced by like automated like checkout, and you know, like you walk into a McDonald's, there's like one person there, and everything else is just computers. So yeah, and I'm not sure like how much of that is being automated, but it's not just like language models, right? Like automation, there's like self-driving trucks and like all that stuff.
Totally.
So yeah, everyone's gonna lose their jobs.
Yeah, it's a question of at which point do we reach that sort of critical point where the pitchforks come out? Because like now we need like a UBI, or we need something, because like we can't employ everybody. Or does it just continue that? Because like history hasn't been that. History has been kind of this vision of a new class of jobs arises that people now fill that are a byproduct of these new technologies. So it's hopefully it's going to be that, and then we can avoid the pitchforks. Hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. So this is something I think about a lot too. So I mean, I went into a Burger King on my way back from Atlanta, and it was kind of dystopian, right? So there was like two people like in this entire restaurant. This like quite a big restaurant. There was like a handwritten sign on one of the registers saying everybody has to use the kiosk. You know, no, you can't order from a human here. So you went over to the kiosk, you put in your order, and then they would just sort of call your name and give you your cup, and then you went over and you filled your own drink. But like the place was like, it was falling apart. Like they clearly didn't have money, like effort or like incentive to like sort of clean or restock anything. And I had to scoop out ice from the bottom of this, like the Coke machine, if I wanted ice. And I had to like there was no large lids for my large soda. So I actually saw one like across the room, and I was like, oh, I like a large lid. I'm gonna go, let me go get that. And I was just thinking like, wow, like this is like, but this is still probably more profitable than like having it full of people who take pride in their work and really care about the experience and stuff like that. And my burger still tasted really good. So I was like, oh, well, I guess this is just what it's like to go to Burger King now. And it made me a little bit sad, because I bet you like, you know, if you went to a Burger King in the 60s, it was probably full of all these young, like hopeful, enthusiastic people sort of taking pride in their work, and they were excited to have this job, and they were like, we want to be, you know, a better restaurant than McDonald's. And now it's almost like just this sort of cap, what do people say? Late stage capitalists. Mm-hmm. Like this sort of the logical conclusion of just like, all right, how can I squeeze the most possible money out of this business that people will still show up and they'll give money to. But yeah, I'm more pessimistic than you, Rachel. Like I know like historically that has happened, but I think also like historically there has been a lot of disruption associated with like technological advancements, like the end of sort of agrarian, sort of the start of industrial farming and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, society sort of worked it out, but there also was a lot of like growing pains to get to that point. And you know, like listen to like Andrew Yang talk about like just how many, like in a number of states in the US, truck driver is the most common job for men. And so if it is true that like automated trucks are coming for those people's jobs, you know, like I don't know if those people are going to get great jobs when they lose their you know, because like you know, they're not going to learn to code, they're not going to sort of go back to university, and you know, they're not going to have like just start like making amazing cool creative things and selling them on Etsy and stuff like that. Like it, I don't know, I think I am worried about. And another interesting thing is that like if you have a huge proportion of society that's not required by the economy, it takes away like the working class's main weapon, which is organized labor, right? So it's always been the main way like the working class can win concessions and sort of win, you know, the 5-day, 40-hour working week, is like by organizing and going on strike. Well, you can't really go on strike if the economy just doesn't really need you to work, like your only recourse is sort of voting and politics. And I don't know, like I just worry that like a broad scale populist movement to be like, hey, no, you rich people controlling this technology need to share the sort of fruits of it, is very, very, I don't know, like kind of unlikely, or just like easy to sabotage, right? Like the whole sort of like, well, we can sort of just distract people, we can sort of divide them, make them sort of fight against each other, like right versus left, or like distract everybody forever with like culture war issues to stop like a broad movement to sort of like take care of people even if they're not working. So I don't know. I do worry, but yeah. Anybody?
Can I make the picture worse?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think so far we've talked about like the disruptions that are coming in the next 5 years in terms of like kind of the white collar jobs being disrupted. I think it's going to get actually substantially scarier the next 5 years, because I think the area where we're going to see some really big moves is going to be entertainment. And so let me see if I could like paint this picture for you guys and the incredible consequences. So Paul knows I'm kind of a nerd and I still love my video games. And there's a video game that came out, I think 5-6 years ago, called No Man's Sky. And it was incredible because it was a full galaxy filled with billions of stars. Those stars all had numerous planets. Every planet is the size of a planet. You could go to any of these places and explore them, like truly a simulated galaxy for you to go and explore. It was really cool, but like totally boring, because like there was no reason to do anything. There's no story. There's no narrative. Well, take that, marry these LLM technologies, and you could imagine that in 5 years, we'll have video games where you could be like, hey, I want to play a 100-hour RPG that is a story like Battlestar Galactica, starring me. And I'll generate that for you. And then when you interact with the NPCs, the computer characters, they can respond to what you're saying. And then the story will adapt. Okay. But then, like, if you're a teenager and you have a girl you like from school, and like as a teenage boy, that is the scariest thing on planet Earth. Take a picture, be like, hey, video game, please scan this character in, make a character out of them. And let that be somebody that is going to be another character in this fantasy I've constructed. So you can very quickly start to construct your own world, literally your own galaxy, where you are the master, where you never need to deal with rejection. You never need to really deal with the consequences of reality. And so like, if we think like social media is bad today in terms of like creating separation and like worsening social skills, run with this for a second. And then it'll come for like just sort of like more passive media, like movies. Like, hey, I'll generate a TV show for me that is the next 7 seasons of Game of Thrones, right? Like just the amount of sort of like mind-numbing content that will now be generatable will be like mind-blowing. And so like, what happens to society when you have that, especially if you have a group that isn't working? You've just given them the drug to keep them docile and just really not thinking or engaging with the world. I think that's like incredibly dystopian. Like I would build this if I didn't think that this would be so evil for planet Earth. Because like I do love my video games. So I'm like, this is so evil. Like this will only be bad. But someone will absolutely build it because it will make them a fuck ton of money. There's no other way. Like this will be so successful.
Well, how are the people who are out of jobs going to be paying for it?
It's a really good question. I think there will be some kind of like safety net, right? Like sort of like Andrew Yang, like universal basic income, but it can be really basic, right? It's just creating even more inequality. But even like if you get the people out of jobs, just think about teenagers. Like if you're growing up, like even today, like I have several friends have teenage kids, like within like 2 weeks of ChatGPT being released, the kids were using it to write their like school papers, right? Which is absolutely not the point of a school paper. Like the school's not interested in reading an opinion piece. They're interested in you learning how to write. then a product had been developed pretty quickly to basically detect if the paper you wrote was by ChatGPT. And then another product arose within a week of that, that would like rewrite the paper ChatGPT wrote, so it was not detectable by the, like, but like, look, kids are going to make that decision all day, every day. Like, I don't want to do homework and I want to play this like video game where I'm the king. So like, what do you get on the other end? I just don't know if that's a productive member of society who's ready to enter the workforce, even if there's a job available.
Yeah, I want to talk about that actually, like for a little bit, the whole kids cheating at school, you know, it's same in college, like professors are concerned about that. Like my take on it is this is a tool that's going to be available to people for the rest of their future. And so like we should be testing their ability to use the tool, not testing their ability to like, you know, generate things on their own. Like the same way we're not really testing people's ability to like do like calculations that they can use a calculator for. In most math classes, they should just use the calculator. Or if they're like writing, you know, something in a Word doc, we're letting them use spell check or Grammarly or whatever. Like this is just the same thing, but more advanced. And like, I think really what we need to be teaching students is how to generate good like prompts that will give them the output that they need, and how to evaluate whether the output is bullshit or like actually true, and how to like revise the output so that it has, you know, it doesn't have mistakes, or like make it better, less repetitive, whatever. But like, why not embrace it since it will be part of people's future?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think like the argument against that is that like the students will miss out on learning something valuable, right? Like that we, no matter how good these things get, we'll still want people. The best human writer will still be better. Will still be better than like the computers, and maybe that person will no longer be able to get to that point without the practice, like if they're just leaning on this tool. But yeah, I don't know, like people use the analogy of a calculator. Like when calculators were invented, you could have said the same thing, like, wait, don't let these teenagers use calculators, like that's just sort of cheating, it's going to make their maths class really easy. But it's like, no, actually it's a tool that they should incorporate, and banning calculators. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't allowed to use a calculator like in primary school, but then yeah, in high school we had calculators and it was great, but like class was still difficult.
So let me see if I could make the argument for the other side to make this a little interesting. And I'll use an example in my own life. So I remember when I was like a high school student, I started tutoring a young girl who lived across the street from me. And she was a ninth grader at that point. And we were just going through some like really basic math stuff, right? It's like -3 + 5, right? Like, what do you get, right? And what kind of blew me away and literally has stuck with me the rest of my life was she had no real intuition for like numbers and like a number line, and that like -1 is 1 less than 0. She knew to put it into a calculator, but that's it, right? That like there's no like, she had missed the learnings of how numbers work, but like sort of the inner meaning of numbers. And I kind of fall on that, like I think the point of like a lot of education, especially like up to like college, it's not so much that the specific thing you're doing is like something you're going to do in the future, but it's more, we're teaching you how to think, how to reason and build like intuitions. I'll tell you like, so like ChatGPT hasn't been a thing up until now, but like, I know like working with a lot of the employees that we have in the customer service space, like it's amazing that people really struggle with writing and reading. Like the most common way we see people spell the word you is with the letter U, just because that's how they've been writing it in DMs and text messages. They didn't grow up with computers. And like, there's like an astounding stat that I read recently that like 53% of Americans do not read at a sixth grade reading level, right? Like, whoa. So like, and I think like if the more tools we give them and the less practice they get, like these kind of, I would almost call it like core skill to think and to interact with the world, I don't know that we're doing them a service. Even like, yes, like it's easier to do math with a calculator. It's like you'll get to the answer faster. You will have it as an adult. But I don't know that that's the point of you just doing the math by hand. I think the point is for you to learn how to reason like through like symbolic logic and like understand sort of intuitively sort of like the nature of numbers and like stuff like that. So that'd be kind of the other side, I think, of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I think like my question, I guess, is like with your example of the girl who doesn't understand numbers, which I also tutored ninth graders who were just like that. And like, I understand. But like, if you, and yeah, like I was, it completely blew my mind. And I was like, this is really important that you understand how numbers work. Like, how could you not? And I spent like a year trying to teach the kids like how numbers work. But like, if you think about it, maybe it doesn't matter that they understand how numbers work. Like if they can, for the rest of their lives, let's just like, I guess this is the empirical question, but like if they can go about their lives and like interact with numbers by using their calculator or, you know, whatever, then like, does it matter that they never understand what numbers are? Like, for all intents and purposes, they're functioning. Like, in the same way that ChatGPT doesn't understand what it's saying, but it's functioning. Like,
so it's a good question. So I think, like, they can function, but are you putting a massive cap in, like, what they can do, right? Like, you know, if you think about this group here, three of us are, like, empirical scientists, and the fourth one is a software engineer. I don't know that any of us could get to the thing that we do without like mastering that, like, you know, negative one is one less than zero and it's two less than one, right? Like, cause it's stats, right? So do you just put such a hard cap on like possible employment to things that are just low leverage and just not really knowledge work? And I don't know the answer, but like, that's what I would worry about as maybe the consequence if we say like, it's okay.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get into too dicey waters with Paul still being on the job market, but I would say that that's like a nature versus nurture kind of thing. And like, yeah. I didn't actually go to school until I was 15. I was unschooled. And so like, no one taught me what numbers were, but I figured it out pretty quickly. And like, here I am. So like, how much of it is actually like, we need to teach people how to think and how to write and how to reason about numbers versus some people just get it and some people don't. But
yeah, maybe we should do that.
Dangerous war waters on this one.
I think an example maybe that is like very easy to see that's not like just nature and nurture is GPS and directions, right? So I think like plenty of very smart people are freely admit that they have like no sense of direction. And I think it's like very, very likely that if they didn't use GPS all the time, they would all have like great senses of direction. Like if you just do like any navigation by yourself, you just like get good at it and you just like practice it and get better at it. And if you just like never do that, which is 100% possible to do, you just like end up like me and you just like cannot like function without like directions, you know, 20, like two blocks from your house, right?
Well, sure. But you and I moved into the same neighborhood at the same time and have been using GPS.
By yourself, whereas I grew up like never needing to like go somewhere without like a blue arrow in a video game pointing me on like where I need to go. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or like walking to school, which is like across the street when I was growing up. And so I just like never was like out needing to like navigate the world. Whereas I'm sure you, like, little independent, unschooled person, like, you know, going on wild, crazy adventures by yourself, you like really developed that skill. And I think that's like, yeah, there's a very strong case, I think, there that that's like primarily a nurture thing. Or,
But it, so, I mean, does it matter though, right? Like, so, I mean,
So I think for
my understanding of Rachel's point is like, you know, like, for example, probably like if we lived 300 years ago, we'd all be a lot better at like churning butter and like, you know, like kneading bread and stuff like that, or like blacksmithing skills. But, you know, just because of like technological developments, we've never had to develop those skills. And but that's okay, because like the economy like sort of takes care of that stuff. So in the same way, I mean, it's a fascinating question and like kind of an interesting question that could have some interesting sort of actual, like, you know, empirical tests that we could think about doing, but like big experiment to do on like the youth of humanity, to be like, all right, like, you no longer have to learn to write paragraphs, you're just going to use this tool, let's see how this goes. And, you know, maybe that's just inevitable, maybe like that's just the way things are going to be, and we'll see where the chips fall as a result.
So here's the crazy thing: we're almost certainly going to get an A/B test on this, and we're going to get an A/B test because like a country like China is going to be much more restrictive in what the youth can do, because like China's already today limiting heavily how many video games children can play, like how many hours a child can play video games a week, how much they can use social media. And I think the thesis is like, this is going to destroy their brains, so let's not do that. And then the next generation will like greatly outperform those American kids that are all going to like absorb it, right? So like, I mean, like when I think about like where this is going, I wouldn't be surprised if like a Chinese company develops this like video game I'm telling you about, the Chinese government bans it in China, and they're like, we'll just give it to the Americans, right? Let's see what happens. And that's going to be fascinating, right? Because like, I don't know that we've had technology really in the history of the human race where like a major like technologically advanced country could be like, we are not signing up for this. Like, we're going to really restrict this, other than maybe like nuclear, right? But like nuclear has like, it's much more limited in sort of like its impact on a day-to-day basis, but like, and on people's like minds. But like, that's going to be really interesting, I think, in terms of, from like, as a psychologist, I'm like, what's going to happen? What is this going to look like in 20 years?
So I'm interested that you raised China, because like one thing I wanted to talk about, and maybe we could sort of shift to too, is like,
I had one last. Just while we're on this, because otherwise, I think like one maybe like really relevant aspect that we don't necessarily have to like spend any time on it, but just of like this whole discussion is like substituting something else, right? Like, you no longer have to think about X, you can now think about Y, and like Y is like higher level and better to think about. So like, I'm definitely like way worse than like the average 70s programmer at assembly, but I'm probably like much better at like distributed systems and like, you know, like dealing with like databases and that sort of thing. And like, I'm definitely like way more productive, right? But but I'm like not as good at like memory management in assembly. And so like, it's just like, you know, because I'm thinking about different things. And so I think like, I'm like just protected by like very good abstractions from like all that like stupid bullshit. And so I think like, and I think like similarly, like, you know, like, Rachel doesn't need to like do an ANOVA by hand, but she can like have a program do it. And, you know, I think there's like a lot of these details where you can sort of like, I think it depends on if you're still sort of doing something, like, you know what I mean? If you can have like a good enough abstraction that you like, it's really not leaky and you really don't need to understand the internals of it, then I think like, maybe that's like a case where it's better. Like, I think like maybe directions is like this sort of like, all I like really need is to like be able to get from point A to point B. It really doesn't like matter like how that happens. I think a lot of things are actually very leaky, and that's why it's like actually important. Like, I actually do know how memory is laid out. Like when I'm like programming, because it matters a lot of the time. And so like, even though there's like these like higher level things, it's like not that great of an abstraction. So it's like super important in some cases. to sort of like be able to get under the hood. And then it is sort of like a downside of sort of like working at this like higher level a lot of the time, where like, you know, maybe like with like writing or something, if you have like really good tools where you're sort of like operating at this higher level where you're sort of like delegating the like wordsmithing activities, you know, like I'm like very confident that that is at least like somewhat leaky, and that like those sort of like tactical decisions that like writers today make that maybe like future writers would be like less competent at, like maybe like that will be like a loss or something like that. But maybe like overall it would be better because like people would be better like tactical or like strategic writers where you can sort of like lay out a book better or something like that. Yeah, I don't know. Or like write a movie better, but then like, you know, yeah, or whatever.
Like, yeah, like a dead author. Like write me the other books J.D. Salinger would have written, like if he had not have died. And then summarize them so I can read them in 2 minutes. Yeah. So I wanted to talk a little bit about like, you know, like long term with this kind of stuff. Cause I, you know, the singularity, which I, as I mentioned, Alex introduced me to, is the idea that at a certain point, artificial intelligence, theoretically will get smart enough to, be smarter than us, right? So it'll reach a point where it can make itself smarter, right? And when you reach that point that AI can work on itself and make itself smarter, you reach this sort of inflection point where things just get a bit crazy, because if it gets a little bit smarter and then it's even better at making itself smarter, then it gets smarter again, and now it's like, and soon it's so much smarter than humans that sort of we can't even really understand what it's doing anymore, right? Like, so it's in terms of intelligence, it's relative to us, like we are to like cats. Like cats, you know, sort of understand what we're doing some of the time, but like not really. They don't really understand our minds and everything going on and our sort of agenda and what we're up to. So this is this idea of like, theoretically, you keep pushing this stuff, you reach the singularity, you create this super intelligence that is just much, much smarter than human beings. And like, it really seems to me that like nobody really knows what happens then. And it's quite interesting and a little bit scary, like to think about. And I could also see a situation where like, you know, Alex mentioned China. You know, these large language models, they're, as you said, they're incredibly expensive to build, right? But if I'm like the US military and I like have access to enormous amounts of sort of resources, I'm kind of at this point thinking, well, there is a real case here that I want to be the first person to, I want the singularity to be reached in the US, in a US military facility. I want to have control of this super intelligence when it arrives on planet Earth. I don't want the Chinese to have control of that. And that you get this sort of arms race, sort of like we're just sort of careening without much thought towards this point, because we want to be the first to reach it, because we're concerned that, you know, bad things might happen to us if somebody else is the first to reach it. So I don't even think I have the framework or imagination to sort of think about what that looks like. But people in the field, like as surveys of experts in the field, sort of put that point within our lifetimes now, or like if they're asked to estimate it. So I'll throw it to Alex first, because like,
yeah,
you're the reason I've even know what the singularity is. But like, what are your current thoughts about it, or like scenarios you play out in your mind about this?
So I was talking really recently to one of the smartest friends I have, and he was saying, you know, we might be the last generation of humans. And like, if you're going to be born in any generation, why, it'd be great to be the last one, right? To see how it all unfolds.
Some downsides.
Some downsides. A lot of pretty painful death of that. Yeah. I mean, like, I think you're absolutely right that we're going to have this like arms race happening, because it'll be exactly that logic. We don't want the Chinese to come up with this first, or we don't want the Russians to come up with this first. We got to do it first. I think like folks that work in the space broadly agree on one thing. We will have very little control of this thing once we create it. So whoever makes it, it's a little bit of a delusion that you think that you're going to be able to lock it down or like have any sort of say, because it's like, you will just not understand, right? Like, so that's really scary. I think the best case scenario I can think of how this goes well, let's move you to there, is this idea that like the human race will cease to exist as we know it, but we will transcend our biological state. So like, let's just walk through like a bit of a thought experiment. So like, Paul, you mentioned you're getting a little older, your memory is not as it once was. Well, imagine I could provide you a chip to put into your brain that will help you expand your memory, make it a bit more accessible, right? Or like, you're already like got your smartphone to access the internet. What if you could just think and Google will just do it and the answer would just come back in? That'd be pretty great. So like, if we start pushing sort of like augmenting ourselves with like machines and starting to even like replace parts of our brain to expand our capabilities, then we could like start to bridge that gap where as we are kind of like these like, you know, soft sacks of water, we probably can't compete with the singularity. But if we start to go beyond it and sort of merge, it's better. And like then you get into crazy things like immortality. Like maybe you don't die then, right? Like maybe within a lifetime, like the immortal human arises. Like it gets very sci-fi very fast. But that, I think, is like all kind of like on the table when we're talking about things like the singularity and what will happen. And like, yeah, yeah. Though, like, if you ask me, like, do I think is the most likely outcome? I think it's we're the last generation and we're all going to die. Like, and I'm a pretty happy, optimistic person. I'm like, but when I think through, like, and maybe it's because I just read like the Three Body Problem trilogy and like that does not paint a positive picture of what another sentient species will do. And I'll stop there, so because I want to spoil
but
the
no, book like, people throw that idea around, but like, do you, how though? Like, is the machine in this scenario hijacking the like nuclear codes and unleashing like nuclear weapons all over the world? Is that it? Or is it unleashing? How's it going to kill us?
Okay, yeah, I wanted to like add this, unless Alex like urgently wants to respond to that. But
No, go.
Yeah, okay. So I think one thing that is maybe missing that we haven't like emphasized is this idea of like why might you be pessimistic, right? That was just what you're asking. And so I think the way that like the AI researchers would call this, would talk about this is like the alignment problem. And so like the idea is like the claim is that it's actually like really hard to get the AI to be aligned, and that's like not self-evident. So I think that's like a really important part of this conversation. But like, so I think maybe I'll like talk about that like for a minute to try to give like people an intuition. I think there's like a lot of good like resources for like learning more about this, though. Maybe like Rob Miles is a good like person to look up on YouTube. But okay, so like here's like maybe a quick way of thinking about the alignment problem. And so one thing is that it's not like obvious, like how would you specify like the goal or something like that of like some, you have like an agent who's like able to like do like, if a genie, right? And you're sort of you can sort of give the genie some kind of utility function. You know, it has a bunch of sensors and it's sort of able to like use its sensors to say like, okay, here's the state of the world. How good is the state of the world? Like, you know, it has like, it's like literally like maybe like it wouldn't have to work like this, but you could imagine it being like, it takes all these sensors and then it goes to a number and it wants that number to be good. And you're like, okay, cool. What's the function that's going to take in like sensory data and then output numbers that we like? And it's not obvious what that thing should be. Okay. So that's one thing. And then like, here's another thing. This agent is like extremely capable. So whatever that, so like in some sense, like, you can't be like very confident about like what the agent's going to do. Cause like, if you knew like how it was going to like try to improve the number or whatever, if you knew how it would do that, you would just be able to do that. So like in some sense, it's unpredictable because it's like much smarter than you. But in another sense, it's like very predictable. That number is going to be optimized, right? And so whatever you tell it to do, it's going to do a fantastic job doing that. And like, And that's kind of scary because if there's like any misalignment, so you can sort of think like, let's say like the optimal direction is here and you're like super close, but you're like a little bit off. You can sort of think like when you're optimizing things, you tend to do this thing like min-maxing, right? So you're making a Dungeons and Dragons character. If you're a warrior, you're setting your intelligence to like 8 or something, whatever your DM is going to allow, because you don't need that. It's a dumb stat. And so when you're optimizing things, lots of things become dumb stats. And like, how do you know that the thing that you told it to optimize for is not going to have dumb stats? Like Dungeon Masters still in 2022, after like 20 years of Dungeons and Dragons, can't really incentivize people to properly make characters with dumb stats. And you're trying to say humans are going to be able to give an AI a utility function that's going to prevent it from having dumb stats that are like relevant to human values. And that's maybe like a sort of way of talking about it, where like, yeah, like it's just like, you know, you're like, oh, make humans happy. And then like all of a sudden, like everyone's just like in a comatose induced state, and like we're all like merged into some like optimized giant brain slug thing that it's like juicing heroin into, you know, and it's like just turning the galaxy into these like giant like slug brain. You know, maybe that's awesome, but that's probably, you know, maybe it's not, you know, like I think there's like a lot, or you know, whatever. So I think that's like one thing. And then maybe like one last other thing, like that's like relevant for why I'm being scary. It's like, I think like there's this idea of like convergent goals, which is like, or instrumentally convergent goals. So the idea is like, it's not what your goal is. Like your goal is to like do something. Then there's like other things that are probably going to be helpful for like a lot of those goals, right? So like if you're a human, something that's like instrumentally valuable is like money. So like, it doesn't really matter what your goals are as a human. Money is like most of the time going to be like helpful for that. And there's a lot of things like that, that you can imagine like AI, like for like, just like arbitrary goals. So like, collecting resources is sort of like the analogy of like having money and like not being turned off, not having your values changed, right? Like if your utility function is something and then the humans change it to something else, now you're probably going to do a crap job of your original thing. And so there's all these things. And that sort of is another way of like saying like, maybe then that's sort of a way that like these researchers try to like think about how might the system behave. And you say like, maybe we don't know what the goal is going to be, but there's all these convergent goals and they're all like really scary, right? And so I think there's like, those are maybe some intuition pumps for like why people are like very pessimistic a lot of the time with this like AI stuff.
Let me add one more vector, because like, I love everything Luke just said. Completely agree, right? Like, this is the whole, like, we will have a hard time controlling it, and our attempts at control will probably lead to disastrously bad outcomes. The other reason you might be pretty skeptical is, like, just what have the humans done every time we've encountered, like, a species that's maybe a threat to us, but, like, less technologically advanced? We've tried to wipe them out. That's literally the history, and it's usually other humans, right? Like, Europeans get to North America, what do? Kill everybody, right? We want it. Unless this AI has, like, fundamentally different drives of survival and, like, threat detection, there's a whole host of reasons why I might think I should wipe these humans out. The other thing I might think is, like, we're totally not a threat. We're nothing because we're now ants. So like, if you're trying to build a, like one of like metaphor I like that I've heard before is like, if we are building like a road and there's an anthill, what do? We pave over the anthill because it doesn't matter to us. Right. So it's like either indifference or concern about our like potential, you know, danger, both lead to us being wiped out. All pretty scary.
That's all interesting, but like, I don't see how any of that is possible just by like producing words, right? Like, so all of these scenarios, like all of a sudden we're in pods. I mean, okay, so the AI maybe could coax us into the pods by like pitching the idea of the pods to like angel investors and then creating the pods and making really convincing ads that get us into the pods. But then we're kind of there of our own volition as well. And like the paving, like, so one of the really interesting things that I heard is that like, we are really, really far away from building a robot that can fix a toilet. Correct. Right. Like, because it's just like, these physical tasks of these actually having these physical sort of robots that can be controlled by the AI and actually do things in the physical world is a much more difficult problem than just like sort of creating this disembodied intelligence. So like, I don't know. I still just sort of think like, So yeah, do you know like what we do? The singularity is like, yeah, yeah, but what are you going to do? Like, where are your robots? Like, we can handle it.
I love this. So, like, fixing the toilet is a good example. Another thing that's a good example is, like, it's really hard for us to build a robot that can fold towels, right? Like, simple task. But you know what we have today? Like, an AI that can fly an F-16. That is a thing that we have today. You know what an F-16 can do? It can launch some missiles. And so it's like, there's like, the joke is like, do we have to crawl before we launch missiles at the humans? And maybe we don't, right? Because like some machines are easier than others. Now, Paul, your question, like, how do you go from this text model to something that can do anything? Very easily. There's going to be a guy like Alex who's going to be trying to figure out, how do I use GPT-3 to do useful things for my like industry? And I'm going to be like, ooh, I know. I'm going to let GPT-3 have access to these APIs to different software. And I'm going to plug it into the internet and give it capabilities to use the internet. So I've really now started to give the AI similar capabilities to Luke. Okay, right. But now it's the best hacker in the world, right? Like, and it could read everything about hacking. And then what happens, right? That's how it can go, right? Like, it is a language model. But if you start connecting it to the internet, what is connected to the internet? Everything. Now, like, yes, there's a lot of precautions that the government will do in terms of like trying to not have like F-16s on the internet or accessible to the internet, right? Like, all that's sensible. But as this thing becomes like this super intelligent thing and maybe gets into factories, right? Like, many factories are on the internet. Maybe it's really much better than us at designing robots and like solving those problems, and it 3D prints some stuff. And away you go. I don't know how it would kill us. Like, I know you asked that question, like, how would it actually kill us? Is it nuclear codes? But like, I think the possibilities are numerous. Like, maybe gets into a bio lab with like little robotic arms and engineers a virus that is like Ebola that has like a 50% kill rate. But you know what? It's going to have a 2-week switch where like once you get infected, nothing happens for 2 weeks. So then it can really spread, because Ebola like gets people really quickly. So it didn't go that bad, right? What if that happens? That's a pretty effective way of like wiping out many humans. I think my point here is it could go many ways.
Well, on that note, we should wrap it up. This has been fun, and I feel like I've actually learned some things. I really, Rachel, you thought it was going to go terribly having four people. I think it actually went pretty well.
Yeah,
she was worried I was going to explain differential privacy.
Yeah, as long as we avoided that, you know.
Just before we go, come on, differential privacy. You got.
Wait, we also have to have Luke plug his top topic.
Oh God, they're going to bully me. okay, so differential, I have a script though, so that's cheating.
Go for it.
I mean, it's not that good. So differential privacy is a way to learn about groups of people without learning too much about any particular individual in the group or in one of the groups. So for example, you might be able to learn about the median income of students who graduated with a bachelor's in psychology from UW-Madison, but without revealing too much information about, you know, Rachel's current income. And it basically achieves this by strategically doing things like clamping large values and introducing noise or randomization into the algorithm. So that's it. Learn about groups. Pretty good. Don't learn about individuals. Protect privacy of individuals.
Awesome. And nice. What is top topic?
Okay. So I feel like people like totally like misrepresent the scenario that it was set up for. But so here's what it does. I'll say what it does and then the context that it's used, which is totally appropriate. So what it does is it's basically a way of curating and then selecting activities for a group. So basically...
We should mention it's an app, right?
Yeah.
It's an app that Luke created.
Yeah. You can try it out if you're listening. But it's just like a fun side project. So basically, here's how it works. So you go into like a group, and then everyone can propose like topics or like activities, okay? And then you see a list of all the topics that have been proposed, and then you can rank them. And then eventually you can say like, you're ready, like you don't have any more things to do and you've sort of like ranked to your satisfaction the set of topics that have been proposed. Once everyone's ready, you can start it. Mm. You can actually start it before everyone's ready. Mm. But and then what it does is it uses ranked choice voting to take all of people's like preferences, and it picks out the most highly rated activity or like topic, and then it says, go do this. Also, when you do the activities, you sort of say how long you want to like commit to do it.
What if I have a super strong preference for one topic?
There's no way to like express that in the current like voting algorithm, but you could potentially like rig it with different voting algorithms if you wanted to have the ability to have that, like to express preferences, like quadratic voting or something like that. Like, so it's pretty agnostic to the voting system. It's just that it currently uses ranking. It actually used to use something way more complicated in the past.
So basically, if you're sitting around with a group of friends and it's awkward and you don't know what to talk about.
So I actually made it for a club that's from like college friends, where we like every week like meet for like 2 hours and we just like talk about like random things. And it's actually like really great for that sort of setting, because it like lowers the bar for like proposing something. Because if you just have a few people and you propose something, it might get selected even if like people aren't that interested, just because of like the dynamics. Whereas with this, you're sort of like just like shotgun a bunch of possible things. And then there's this like very sort of like nice, like frictionless system for sort of saying like, this is what the group has like a consensus of like what we should sort of, not consensus, but it's like a sort of like a very legitimate way of frictionlessly sort of deciding the next thing to talk about. And it's great because you can have like, as a group, can easily come up with like, you know, like 30, like, you know, 15 minute topics. And just imagine talking about like in 2 hours, you know, 8 different interesting 15 minute topics. It's like a lot of fun. So that's sort of like the idea.
Sounds good. Sounds good. I'll probably stick with my method of just launching into a monologue and saying whatever I want to say, like, regardless of, but that's, you know, that's why I don't have fans. That's why everybody's approaching Rachel instead of me. Anyway, Alex, Luke, Rachel, thank you all. That was fun. We may never make another podcast. Maybe Rachel's fans keep emailing her and messaging her, and then she'll keep producing for you. And I guess I'll come along for the ride.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye, guys.